Life after the caravan, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Anna was part of that migrant caravan crossing Mexico a few weeks ago, but she was pregnant and scared. Now she's in Connecticut with a new baby applying for asylum.
Anna breaks down and pounds the table. She says she didn't even want to come here. It was for her girl, a new baby.
Also, Mexico's presidential candidates would rather not talk about the violence there.
They almost don't want to touch this. They say this is something that the current presidency needs to deal with.
Plus, one of Canada's top women soccer players makes the cut for a men's team.
This isn't about equality. This is purely about my desire to develop and to be better and to be one of the best goalkeepers in the world.
But they won't let her play. Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Thanks for joining us today. Remember that group of Central American migrants making their way through Mexico, the so-called caravan that President Donald Trump said needed to be stopped? It's a story that we followed on the show, and as that caravan got more attention from the media and from tweets, some people left it and decided to try to make it to the U.S. on their own, like the story of the family that we're going to start off with today. Here's The World's Jasmine Garst.
They showed up a little over a month ago. Anna, 8 months pregnant, with her 4-year-old daughter. They didn't have shoes on. They were covered in mud. They'd crossed the Rio Grande, Texas, and walked. When they saw Border Patrol agents, Anna says they turned themselves in and were detained while officials contacted her family, an aunt in Connecticut.
Me dijeron que por mi embarazo no me iban a tener mucho.
They told her that because she was pregnant, she'd be released soon. They were let out the next day. Anna says on the condition that she'd check in with immigration while waiting her court proceedings. A pregnant migrant and her child, afraid to return to Honduras, are released from detention while waiting their day in court. It's a practice President Trump wants to end. So does Attorney General Jeff Sessions.
I have put in place a zero tolerance policy for illegal entry on our southwest border. If you cross the border unlawfully, then we will prosecute you. It's that simple.
Sessions said this after Anna and her daughter arrived. Today, she might have been treated differently. Kept in detention, no exceptions, and separated from her child. A Department of Homeland Security spokesperson says the new orders mean a much stronger focus on prosecuting border crossers, including people like Anna and her daughter fleeing violence. So maybe Anna got in under the wire, but she doesn't feel so lucky.
Me insultó y me dijo que creía.
In Honduras, Anna says she faced threats. Her little brother had refused to join a gang, so a gang member demanded that she pay them off or be killed. She knew the threats were real. Anna worked in forensics in one of the most dangerous areas of Honduras. She says she saw bodies wrapped in canvas on the streets. Terrified and pregnant with a second child, Anna grabbed $100 and, with her boyfriend and daughter, headed north to Mexico. And ran into something unexpected. A large caravan of migrants and activists heading north, raising awareness of the violence and poverty Central Americans are fleeing and their dangerous journey. Anna and her family joined the group. Then Trump started tweeting and weighing in.
Are you watching that mess that's going on right now with the caravan coming up?
I think I didn't personally realize how much a tweet from Donald Trump was going to skyrocket the caravan into the media the way that it did.
Alex Mensing is with Pueblos Sin Fronteras. They helped organize the caravan. He says the president's statements put pressure on migrants.
There was a lot of uncertainty about whether the caravan would continue.
Anna and her family decided to leave the caravan and bus it north alone. It went smoothly until they reached the border near Texas.
Bueno, nomás nos bajamos del autobús, entramos a la terminal.
When we got off the bus, she says, a man grabbed my daughter's hand. Anna says cartel members took them hostage, along with other Central Americans.
Ellos hablaban de $3,000.
Anna says it cost $1,100 to free her and her daughter, $3,000 for her boyfriend. Anna's family managed to pay the ransom for her and her daughter. Her boyfriend was left behind. This all happened about a month ago. Now, Anna is here in Connecticut at her aunt's house. As promised, after giving birth, she's checked in with local immigration agents. They put an electronic ankle monitor on her. She has no court date yet, no lawyer.
¿Te parece el papá? ¿Cómo lo ves?
Do you think the baby looks like his father? She asks and shows me a picture of a handsome young man, her boyfriend, who may or may not join her in America. She's unsure where he is now. We also meet on a Friday, the day immigration officials are supposed to scan her ankle monitor. We wait. Anna serves her daughter Fruit Loops. They play tic-tac-toe. We watch trashy midday TV. After 8 hours of waiting, nobody shows up at Anna's house. The Trump administration is arresting more immigrants. That means a bigger caseload for immigration officers. For 2 weeks, no one shows up. Anna breaks down and pounds the table. She says she didn't even want to come here. It was for her girl and new baby. Anna pulls herself together, rubs the skin under her ankle monitor, and takes another look down the street. No one is coming. For the World, Jasmine Garst, Connecticut.
Well, her story is a very familiar pattern.
That's Doris Meissner. She's with the Migration Policy Institute and is also the former Commissioner of Immigration and Naturalization Services under President Bill Clinton. INS was the precursor to Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. Meissner says the Trump administration has been hard on people like Anna, who cross the border and then turn themselves in so they can apply for asylum in the United States.
The Trump administration has characterized that as a loophole in the law and has been very critical of what they term catch and release, which is what has taken place with this woman. That is that she has been connected with a relative in the United States and then waits for a court date in order to be able to have a judge hear her case for asylum. That is all within the boundaries of U.S. law, but it's now all being described by the new administration as weaknesses and as lax enforcement and as people coming to take advantage of the U.S. system. And therefore, this most recent announcement that you just played about prosecuting people who come across the border in these ways. In my opinion, it is the wrong answer to the problem. I mean, it certainly is an issue at the border that people are coming from Central America, but they're coming from Central America for reasons of violence and persecution. And the issue is who are the ones that legitimately have a claim to asylum and who are the ones that don't and therefore need to be returned to their country because they don't have a status here. To do that, you need immigration judges and you need asylum officers. Prosecutions by U.S. attorneys in federal district courts are not going to solve that problem.
And in this story, the mother and her child are released from detention as their court case plays out. But the Trump administration wants to stop doing that. And we're already seeing cases of children separated from their parents. Do you agree with this?
No, I don't agree with it because I don't think that it solves the problem. I mean, I think it is a legitimate concern to decide these cases, but to call people in these circumstances who are crossing the border, people that are benefiting from legal loopholes, is inaccurate.
Now, part of the story is rooted back in 1996. That's when Congress and President Clinton approved a bill that made immigration enforcement much stricter. It made more people deportable, and deportation skyrocketed after that. It also put more immigrants in detention, even for small crimes. In key ways, this law laid the groundwork for the tougher crackdown on immigrants happening today. Meissner oversaw immigration enforcement in 1996, so I asked her if it's fair that the Trump administration is taking heat on its policies when it was the Clinton administration that laid the foundation for them.
Well, the 1996 laws were of significant change in the legal structure from what had taken place in the past. The 1996 laws most definitely put a much more harsh legal structure into place. The asylum system really worked very effectively from the mid-90s, and I can say that because I was responsible for putting it into place, and it was a very effective reform. And that worked well as part of the immigration system until about 2014. And in 2014, it began to break down because of a very significant surge across the southwest border of Central Americans. And neither the prior administration, the last couple of years of the Obama administration, and certainly not now in the Trump administration, has there been an effective sense of urgency and response and reallocation of resources that aligns with this new set of circumstances.
So do you feel bad as former INS commissioner or regret where all this has landed with Donald Trump?
Well, I certainly regret the fact that Donald Trump is president. I think that his approaches to immigration are not in the best interests of us as a country. Do I feel bad? I mean, the Congress writes the laws. The Congress wrote laws in 1996 that guides the executive branch's work, but you have some discretion in how those laws were implemented. I'm comfortable with the way in which we implemented those laws. I am very uncomfortable with the approach that the Trump administration is taking, but I don't feel any responsibility for it. The choices that they're making are very different choices from those that I made and that the Clinton administration made. And I think that ultimately this administration is creating so much more divisiveness around immigration. We don't know how that is going to end up, but their approach is a very different one, even though we're dealing with the same set of statutes.
Doris Meissner, senior fellow at the Migration Policy Institute and former commissioner of INS, thanks very much.
Thank you.
A quick look ahead now at a story we'll have for you on the show next week. Abortion is likely to be a hot-button issue in the run-up to the midterm elections in the U.S. later this year. But in Ireland, it's front and center right now. And that's because next Friday, Irish voters will take part in a referendum. They'll be deciding whether or not the country should repeal its constitutional ban on abortion. We'll hear from Ciara O'Connor-Walsh. She's been talking with people in Ireland on all sides of the abortion debate for her referendum-related podcast. And she's also shared her own experience with abortion.
It was difficult for me to talk about. Nobody wants to really, you know, I mean, we have an expression in Ireland, airing your dirty laundry. Nobody wants to air their dirty laundry in public like that, really. But, you know, for me, I felt that what was really missing from the conversation about abortion in Ireland is women's stories. And silence has been used as a tool for a long time in Ireland to keep things under wraps. And, you know, that's happened across the board in different issues in Irish society. And I think that women telling their stories is really what's going to change hearts and minds here. And so I thought if I was making a podcast and I was going to be asking women to do that for me, that I also needed to share my own story.
Lots more about Ciara and her podcast next week here on the show. Coming up, we've got the next round, how one British pub is preparing for this weekend's royal wedding. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with the world. This next story comes from our Across Women's Lives desk. It's about a Canadian named Stephanie Labbé. 2 years ago, she was the goalkeeper for Canada's bronze medal-winning Olympic soccer team in Rio. After the games, Labbé wanted to keep playing professionally in Canada at the highest level possible, but there are no professional women's teams there, so she tried out for the Calgary Foothills men's team, and she made the cut. But the league the Foothills play in, the Premier Development League, or PDL, said no because they say they are a men's league. Stephanie is on the line with us from Calgary. You're considered Canada's top-ranked female player. Did you go into the tryout for the Foothills pretty confident that you'd make the cut?
Yeah, I'd like to first off change that statement, as I don't think Christine Sinclair, our team captain, would be very happy with me being named the top Canadian
player. Okay, you're considered one of Canada's top female players.
Okay, we'll go with that.
Okay.
You know, for me, I wanted to challenge myself and put myself in an environment where I would be pushed every day and be challenged to my limits. And, you know, I've trained with men in the off seasons before, so I knew how much of a challenge it is and how much it pushes me and how much it helps my development in a whole new way.
Only to be then told by the league that you can't play on the men's team. Was that a surprise to you?
Yeah, it was. You know, for it to be something that, you know, I can't control at the end of the day, my gender. If it was that, you know, I'm not fast enough, I'm not strong enough, I'm not good enough, those things I can go home at the end of the day and work on. And it's a bit disheartening in the sense of there's not much you can do about it.
The Calgary Foothills, the club you tried out for, they have both a men's team and a women's team. They call their women's team Canada's highest level women's club team. Why not play with that squad?
So the women's team is a semi-professional, so it's not a full professional team. And, you know, if I'm going to play for a women's team, it needs to be a professional women's team and for it to last all season. Don't get me wrong, the caliber of the girls is great. But for me, it was finding an environment that was going to push me every day. And I knew that being in the men's environment was going to do that.
Do you think there's any chance the league will change its mind?
Of course, I'm very hopeful. But the way that the league has responded, and by responded, I mean lack of responded, really, to anything further than the initial conversation, I don't have any beliefs that it's going to change.
I gather, though, that there are numerous petitions circulating asking for you to be on the team. So could the pressure make a change?
That would be amazing if it could. Yeah, the support's been incredible. And the amount of people that have reached out from all walks of life has been pretty overwhelming and humbling. But at the end of the day, I think that they have their opinion and their rules, and they're pretty set on it.
I was super impressed by Canada's women's team in the Women's World Cup. I mean, why doesn't the country have a professional women's soccer league?
Yeah, it's growing. You know, soccer's really come onto the stage in the past 6 years since the London Olympics. It's really blown up here in Canada. And now, especially with the new men's professional league that's going to be starting up next year, is a huge step forward in Canadian soccer. And I think that that's a huge platform for us. And now, hopefully moving forward, we'll luckily add in some women's teams to that because, you know, for us to have the opportunity to stay at home, play professionally in front of our friends and family would be amazing. And it would just start developing more and more female players here in our country.
Have you heard from any young women who look up to you, who see you as a role model?
Yeah, I've had so many messages from parents of young girls playing in boys' leagues and that there's not enough women's teams out there for them at their age or that they're not being challenged enough. And I think it's just really cool to know that there's 10-year-olds out there that are wanting to do the same thing and wanting to push their development. And it just holds the future bright for women's soccer in Canada.
So, Stephanie, you're kind of a groundbreaker in this respect.
You know, I don't really look at it that way. You know, I didn't do this for the media. I didn't do it for attention. I did this truly based on my desire to develop and to be one of the best goalkeepers in the world and to help Canada to win a World Cup in the next coming years.
What's next for you?
Yeah, so I'm still training full time with the men's team here. It's a great environment, and I'm improving every single day. And
so you're training with the men's Foothills?
Yes.
So they're letting you do that?
Oh, yeah. And I'm in contact with a couple clubs over in Europe to hopefully sign and head over there in July.
Men's teams or women's teams?
Women's.
Women's, yeah. You know, as I got ready for this interview, I was thinking about solutions. Should there be a single league, like mixed gendered? And do you worry that might mean a lot of women might not have any league to play in at all?
No, I think that there's a reason why we have women's leagues, and that's because there is a clear fact that men have a genetic biological advantage in sports. The way that men are built, their muscles, everything, they have a genetic advantage. And that's why we've created women's leagues, is so that women have an equal and fair opportunity. So I am all for all women's leagues. But for me, if I'm able to overcome those genetic differences and prove that technically I'm able to keep up, then that's when I think there could be an exception and my abilities are good enough.
Stephanie Labbé, who in her modesty insists that I say she is one of Canada's best women's soccer players. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we've avoided it all week, but time to give in. Tomorrow, a member of the British royal family is getting married. Prince Harry, sixth in line to the throne, will wed Meghan Markle, an American actress, and the Brits are, as they say, rather excited. Nowhere more so than in the ancient royal town of Windsor, where the couple are getting hitched.
It's a massive day. It's a massive day for everyone around here.
Toya Mitchell works at the Queen Charlotte Pub in downtown Windsor. I caught up with her a little earlier.
It's actually pretty busy. Prince Harry and Prince William have just actually come out of the castle. So everyone sort of stepped outside the pub with their drinks, trying to get an eyeful.
How far away is the pub from the actual castle? Like, what can you see from there?
We're less than 50 feet. If you step out and walk along the road a bit, you're able to see everything.
So tomorrow for the actual wedding, I understand that there's a special gin that the Queen Charlotte Pub is going to be serving. What's that about?
So we have our gin called Ginina, and it is based on our classic gin that we make here. And we've added a few more ingredients, the main ingredient being ginger, of course, because of Prince Harry.
He's a redhead. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, so it's a very fun way of sort of putting a twist on it.
So what is different about Harry and Meghan Markle compared to the other royals?
I think this one's a little bit more special to a lot of people, obviously, with Prince Harry marrying Meghan Markle. It's a big deal for the Americans. But having it here in our hometown in Windsor is obviously a big deal for all of us locals, and we think it's fantastic. The atmosphere is lively 24/7 at the moment. Personally, I think they come across a little bit more down to earth. A lot of people love the realism of the couple.
Where are you going to be watching the wedding?
From the pub. I'm working tomorrow, but I'll definitely be watching it from the pub.
What would you do if Harry and Meghan came to the pub tomorrow after the wedding, just for a, you know, like a little cocktail?
I would 100% be happy to serve them and congratulate them. And that would be everything. That would be so magical.
Toya, one of the bartenders at the Queen Charlotte Pub in Windsor, just 50 feet from Windsor Castle. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
I'm Marco Werman. Scientists fighting a new Ebola outbreak in Congo say they need money and fast.
Given that the West Africa Ebola outbreak cost $3 to $4 billion because the world allowed it to get out of control, it just is striking that we haven't been able to raise yet the $25 million required to stamp this outbreak out.
That story still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Earlier this week, we reported that there were 30 possible new cases of Ebola in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Today, word is that there are now 45 confirmed new cases. Until now, these cases had been confined to mostly remote areas of Congo, but the virus has now spread to a crossroads city of more than 1 million people. Dr. Peter Salama is a head of emergency preparedness and response for the World Health Organization. He calls the latest news from Congo a game changer.
When Ebola hits an urban area, and we saw this most dramatically in 2014 and 15 in Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea, it can have much more explosive transmission. And so that's our fear with this confirmation of the case in Bandaka, the provincial capital of Equator Province in the northwestern part of Democratic Republic of Congo. The second difference is healthcare workers have been infected. Now, that's tragic in its own right, but it's also a factor that causes amplification, quick amplification of transmission, because healthcare workers tend to have a lot of contacts. So when a healthcare worker is infected, it often means that many other people can be infected quite quickly. And then the other big difference here is we've got multiple sites of infection at the same time. So you've got the small town of Bikoro, you've got another small village that's entirely inaccessible at the moment called Ikobo. You can only reach by motorcycle, which takes several hours, if not days. We haven't been able to even land our helicopters in that village yet. And then you've got the town of Mandaka. So you've got 3 to 4 different sites, and we've got to stamp the outbreak out in all of those places simultaneously.
You recently tweeted a photo of Ebola vaccines being unloaded from a cargo hold of planes arriving in the DRC capital today of Kinshasa. It's really a challenge, isn't it, determining who will and who won't get these vaccines? How are you going to do that fairly?
A lot of challenges actually associated with the vaccine. I mean, the first and foremost is a logistic challenge. This vaccine needs to be kept at between negative 60 and negative 80 degrees Celsius. And you can imagine in the context of a really hot, humid country, a tropical climate, where actually you don't have electricity or power in the majority of the area of operation for this campaign, it's going to be an enormous challenge logistically in itself. But you're right, we also need to be careful and very strategic about how we use the vaccine. That's why we use an approach called ring vaccination, and it's based on the technique that eradicated the disease smallpox in the 1970s. So rather than the vaccination programs everyone's familiar with, where you just vaccinate everyone in a geographical area, here you pinpoint the case of Ebola, and then you find every person that's had contact with that case, and you vaccinate those contacts. So this is much more targeted, and that's why we can do this with a relatively small amount of vaccine.
So minus 60 to minus 80 degrees Celsius, that's like minus 70 to minus 112 degrees Fahrenheit. Is there any place in Congo where you can get those temperatures?
In Kinshasa, we've managed to find a place. So that's where the 4,000 doses we've already shipped is sitting at the moment, until we've worked out really how we're going to get it to these remote rural locations, and then how we're going to keep it cold right up until the time where the campaign starts. But we are using some new technologies, a new technology called Arctic, and it's a pretty cool technology where basically super-freezed ice is in a cylinder, and that can keep around 300 doses at the negative 60 to negative 80 degrees Celsius range for a period of time, right up until the moment when we need to vaccinate. And that's a mobile cylinder. It's able to be carried around easily on a plane or even in a car.
How effective are these vaccines expected to be?
In a trial in Guinea, which had similar field conditions to where we're using the vaccine in Democratic Republic of Congo, it was basically 100% effective and quite safe.
So bottom line, is the international community responding quickly enough to this outbreak in Congo?
So I have to say, in terms of the responders, and starting with the government, who've been extremely quick to confirm and declare the outbreak, and to all of the other responding agencies working under the WHO coordination, actually it has been very robust. I mean, we're talking about only day 9, Marco, of the outbreak, and already we've got more than 100 people on the ground from WHO. We've got mobile labs in place. We've got surveillance in place. We've got the vaccination program approved and being prepared to be launched. We've got the vaccines in country. So things have moved actually very quickly, considering the logistic challenges in this part of the world, which is basically dense forests for hundreds of kilometers. What hasn't moved so fast is the funding. And it surprises me, actually. It's going to take about $25 million to stop this outbreak in the first few months. And given that the West Africa Ebola outbreak cost $3 to $4 billion because the world allowed it to get out of control, it just is striking that we haven't been able to raise yet the $25 million required to stamp this outbreak out.
DR Congo has dealt with Ebola before, not at a scale as to what we saw in West Africa in 2014. But does that give them an advantage to recognizing the early signs and how quickly you need to move?
There's definitely some advantages. The fact that the Congolese medical experts and public health experts who have been involved in this are some of the most experienced clinicians and public health professionals with Ebola. So the expertise for Ebola actually lies mainly in Congo when you look around the world. So that's a great advantage, of course. The other advantage is that the population is also familiar with Ebola, and they know that they've defeated Ebola in the past. So although it's always a fearsome disease because of the bleeding symptoms that many patients get, it's not something that the Congolese are not familiar with.
Dr. Peter Salama with the WHO in Geneva. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Ebola is a very real problem there in Congo. Our next story is about trying to stop the spread of fake news. Not here in the U.S., but in Kenya. President Uhuru Kenyatta recently signed a law that tries to tackle fake news. My colleague, the BBC's Africa business editor, Larry Madoa, joins me from Nairobi. What does the law say exactly?
So this law criminalizes abuse of people on social media, and it removes the legal vacuum that existed before. At least that's how the Kenyan government sees it. But a lot of rights organizations, a lot of people in the opposition, media, bloggers, see this as so much more than that. For instance, they say it contains several broadly defined offenses with harsh sentences that could dramatically chill freedom of expression online in Kenya. So it introduces fines for offenses like fake news, cyberstalking, child pornography, but the extent of the offenses and the jail sentences are what a lot of people have issues with.
I mean, laws to prevent cyberbullying and child pornography, I mean, I can't see anything wrong with that. Why has this measure made people so angry in Kenya?
It's the extent to which these definitions can be stretched. They are not very clearly defined, which means it's open to interpretation. And given the history of the country in dealing with freedom of speech, a lot of people looking at this say the government can abuse this, can use national security, can then drag bloggers, can drag journalists into jail and then drag them before a judge. And if you get a sympathetic judge, they might be able to use the same broad definition to throw you in jail. And that's problematic.
So in the U.S., we've seen politics and elections transformed by social media. What kind of effect do you think Facebook and other apps have had on Kenya's election?
So a lot of scrutiny was spent on the work of, say, Cambridge Analytica in the U.S. election, in the Brexit campaign. But Cambridge Analytica did work in the Kenyan election, in the last two Kenyan general elections, for instance, both times for President Kenyatta's team. Then also another factor was fake news. WhatsApp is very big in Kenya. It's very big all over Africa. And it is very easy there to spread misinformation because it's hard to track where a video or a text piece or a picture came from, and it spreads very quickly. So there's still a lot of ground to cover in terms of exactly what regulations you need to balance between freedom of expression and allowing and making sure that there's nothing harmful that is going on these platforms.
I'm also intrigued by the use of the term fake news. Is that inspired by President Trump?
Absolutely. Fake news, in the way it's applied in Kenya, certainly is inspired by President Trump. And in the way that it is understood as well, it's very Trumpian in the sense that if you do not like anything you see in the media, even if it is true, you can just dismiss it as fake news and then you don't have to engage with it.
Wow. I mean, has that been kind of sweeping through Kenya since the inauguration?
It's been sweeping through Kenya and it certainly picked up. Before President Trump popularized the term fake news, I didn't really hear it in application. And I worked in Kenyan media before. But after his election and obviously how popular he made fake news, politicians are using it very commonly, but in everyday conversation as well. As long as you don't like something or you disagree with it or it paints in bad light, just dismiss it as fake news, done.
Larry, I'm curious, is there any particular fake news story that really caught your eye, maybe a story that got the better of you?
You know, in the last election season in Kenya in the last year, there were several fake news stories produced or in support of the main campaigns. President Kenyatta's campaign and his rival Raila Odinga both had stories that appeared to be from CNN, appeared from the BBC, appeared to be from local media like NTV, but were completely unfounded, had no basis in fact, but was spread very quickly on social media. And I've had stories written about me, for instance, on blogs that were completely not true. Nobody reached out to me, but they were out there, and a lot of people believed them.
My BBC colleague, their Africa business editor, speaking with us from Nairobi, Larry Madowo. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I don't know if you've ever tried an e-bike. These are bicycles with small electric motors that give you a little extra oomph when you need it, sometimes a surprising amount of oomph. E-bikes are taking off in parts of Europe and in China, and they might be catching on here in the U.S. as well. The World's Jason Margolis went for a test ride.
I bike to work, sometimes. I have a series of big hills each direction that just kill me. So when I heard about a new shiny red wheel born in the labs of MIT, I was intrigued.
Everything is contained within the red hub, so the battery, the motor, all the sensors.
Megan Morrow shows me the Copenhagen wheel, named for a challenge by the mayor of the Danish capital to get more people biking. It's built by the company Super Pedestrian in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Morrow says the wheel measures a rider's biometrics as they pedal.
The torque, the cadence, the power that they're putting onto those pedals, and it kind of crunches those numbers and figures out exactly how much motorized assistance to give the rider.
The motor stops giving you a boost after 25 miles per hour. You can go 30 miles on a charge. Okay, enough chatter. I wanted to see this wheel in action. I went out for a ride with John O'Toole, also with Super Pedestrian.
I mean, you feel it right away.
Yeah, that's the cool thing.
We got up to 20 miles per hour in a few seconds. We came across a slight upgrade, no problem. But for me, I want to make sure it can conquer the big hills, the ones that keep me from cycling to work more often.
We'd probably have to go to Summerville, honestly. I mean, there's massive hills in Summerville.
15 minutes later, there we were.
It's a serious hill.
Yeah, it's a serious hill. I mean, personally, I would probably avoid this hill and go a longer route. But with the Copenhagen wheel, you should be able to glide up it pretty effortlessly.
All right, let's try.
And 90 seconds later,
we're going 13 miles an hour
And we just crushed that hill.
Yeah, in seconds.
That was awesome.
Yeah, so you
I feel so strong right now.
Yeah, it's like biking with superpowers.
I wasn't winded, the ride was smooth, and it was fun. It was still a workout, yet this feeling kept nagging at me. Is this cheating?
I mean, you know, we hear that from pure cyclists pretty often, but that's not necessarily the audience we're exclusively going after.
Super Pedestrian's target market is commuters, like O'Toole himself.
If I was to take a car every day to my commute, which is 2.1 miles, it would take around 30 minutes to get through the city to where I work. When I take the Copenhagen Wheel, it's 12 minutes, door to door. So if that's cheating, then so be it.
We don't see it as cheating. We see it as something that helps you.
Klaus Bondum is CEO of the Danish Cyclist Federation, a group formed in 1905. Even in flat Copenhagen, Bondum says e-bikes serve a purpose, allowing riders to cover greater distances.
Especially in the commute from the suburb to the city, the e-bike is an extremely efficient, good alternative to sit stuck in a car queue, having to pay a lot of money for parking. And we know also from scientific research that you do actually get exercise from being on an e-bike also.
Bondum says sales of e-bikes have gone up and up and up over the past 2 years in Europe, and not just in cycling centers like Copenhagen and Amsterdam.
You also see a big increase in countries like Germany and Norway, and especially Sweden, that from 1st of January initiated a legislation where if you buy an e-bike, you can deduct 25% of the price of the e-bike on your tax revenue every year for the next 4 years.
There are clear advantages to more e-bikes and fewer cars. Less congestion and air pollution, fewer greenhouse gases spewing from tailpipes, and more active, healthier people. Still, Bondum says the explosion of e-bikes has brought problems. They make people feel like they're stronger cyclists than they really are.
We have seen an increasing number of seniors getting fatally injured, getting killed on e-bikes. I think 6 or 7 of them are over 80 years old.
There's an even bigger safety challenge facing e-bikes in the United States.
Our cities are just not built for really what people perceive as safe bicycling.
Ben Welly works on road safety issues with the World Resources Institute in Washington.
If you're not willing to go out and bicycle on a regular bicycle, the chances then of saying, well, I want to take an e-bike, which sort of is harder to maneuver, can go at fast speeds, which might not be in your control. The situation of the American city is just not built for what I see right now of scaling this up to a really big deal.
That said, Welly says many American cities have made strides with cycling infrastructure in recent years. But there's one last problem with e-bikes: cost. They sell for about $1,500 to $2,000 or more. That's a lot pricier than most traditional bikes. But John O'Toole with the Copenhagen Wheel says don't look at the comparison that way.
If we look at it as a comparison to cars and other forms of transportation, the average cost of owning a car in the U.S. is about $8,000 a year. This is $1,500.
Still, no matter how cool an e-bike might be, it's not a car. Then again, maybe that's a good thing.
You just feel better. The day feels like you can start and end the day much happier than sitting in Boston traffic.
For The World, Jason Margolis, Cambridge, Massachusetts.
On July 1st, Mexicans will choose their next president. And this weekend, they'll be watching and listening as the candidates gather for their second debate. One thing that's likely to be talked about is how they'd handle organized crime if they're elected. The situation is bad. Since last fall, 88 candidates for offices across Mexico have been killed. Reporter Jorge Valencia has been reporting on this. He joins us now from the Mexico City Bureau of Public Radio Station, KJZZ. To be clear, Jorge, and not to downplay the murdered politicians, have any presidential candidates been killed?
No, and they haven't received any credible threats that we know of. This is mainly targeting candidates at the local level, at the city level, some at the state level, because, I mean, you could totally bet that if it had been at the presidential level, this would be getting much more attention. It wouldn't be just us talking about it.
How high profile are some of the candidates who've been killed, and how are they being attacked?
Well, these candidates are people who are running for mayor or are running for their state's chamber of deputy, which is the lower house of government here, and they are being killed in the way that you would imagine. There was a case just last week in which there was a mayor who was running for the chamber of deputies, and he was gunned down, and then he was left in his truck.
So what's going on? I mean, 88 people running for office of some sort being murdered. That's really mind-boggling.
Well, the worst part about this is that what's going on has been going on for years. The difference this time around is that Mexico had electoral reform a few years ago in which the federal government encouraged the states to have their elections right around the same time that national elections are happening. So they're coinciding with the presidential elections, which are happening in about 6 weeks. And it's simply much more visible, these either threats or homicides that we're seeing.
So if this has been going on for such a long time in Mexico, what's been the cumulative effect of all this violence on the political system?
So I spoke to a professor here. Her name is Sandra Ley. She teaches at a very prestigious university here that's known by its acronym, CIDE. And she looked at elections over the last 20 years or so. She also conducted a survey after the last presidential elections in 2012. And what she found was a direct correlation that when there are homicides or there are just threats, voters notice.
This tells us something about the awareness that voters have about what's going on with elections.
So in other words, what we see is that voters can tell when the elections are being tampered with, and they grow discouraged.
What does that mean in terms of election results?
Well, depending on who you ask, some of the candidates who have received threats, they'll say that basically some of the people who are getting elected to be mayor, for example, they're running under major parties, but some of them are candidates that are being sanctioned by organized crime groups.
So do we have any idea of which groups are suspected of actually interfering with the elections and what their motives are?
So there's one state that I was particularly interested in. It's in the southern part of the country, Guerrero. There's a lot of opium, poppy farming there. There's this area called Tierra Caliente. It's called hot land. And there are both cartels that are fighting over territory. And then there are also what have become known as cartelitos. So basically smaller organized crime groups. These are primarily funded through drugs. And these are the groups that are fighting over this. I spoke to Armando Rios Peter. He is a senator from Guerrero. And he sees this as a shared responsibility.
A lot of the heroin that's consumed in the United States comes from Guerrero, so we both, as countries, have a problem.
Yeah, so you also spoke, I gather, to a candidate from the state of Guerrero who withdrew because of death threats.
Yes, this is actually quite harrowing. Her name is Silvia Rivera Carvajal. She is currently actually finishing her term in Congress, and she was running to represent this area, again, Tierra Caliente, hot land, and the state chamber of deputies. She told me that she had actually been kidnapped a few years ago, and that when she was campaigning, she started hearing from some of these constituents that she was meeting with.
It started with the people I was visiting for my campaign. They were telling me that they were being told not to vote for me, otherwise they were going to have problems. And then I got two phone calls.
After we had this phone call, just a couple of days later, I got in touch with her. And that candidate we were talking about just a few minutes ago, that mayor who was killed, it was actually a friend of hers.
Wow.
So she was actually quite concerned. She said, listen, I don't want to talk anymore. I don't know what's going to happen. They're either going to come for me or they're going to come for my family.
Yeah, that is really harrowing. So the presidential candidates, how do they say they plan to address this violence? And are security issues really the number one worry among voters?
Security is, I would say, among the top three. Mexico is a country with a really big and strong economy, but is really bogged down by corruption. And so probably the number one issue is corruption, and it goes hand in hand with security. Now, in terms of the presidential candidates, it's not really an issue that's being talked about. The majority of these candidates who are being killed are members of the PRI, which is the party of the current president. He himself has said very little about this. And I've spoken to some of the surrogates from some of the candidates, and they almost don't want to touch this. They say this is something that the current presidency needs to deal with.
So regardless of who ends up winning and who is in charge of the country, is the expectation that not much is going to change?
You know, I wish I could answer that question. It's something that I myself have been asking some of these experts, some of the politicians that I've spoken with. And it seems that people are hopeful that there can be change, that this situation can improve. But it's just something that would take a really long time, a very conscious effort, because the problem is systemic. And so the changes need to be systemic.
Jorge Valencia, reporter with public radio station KJZZ's Mexico City Bureau. Thank you.
Thank you, Marco.
And the antidote for the news this week? A little story I got thanks to the Janet Jackson fans' Twitter feed. Remember Jackson's Rhythm Nation? We are part of a Rhythm Nation, People the World Unite, Strength in Numbers, we can get it right. The album came out in the fall of 1989, and then Janet Jackson took Rhythm Nation on a world tour and made it Rhythm Planet. Janet Jackson there at the Tokyo Dome this week in 1990 on that Rhythm Nation tour. The footwork alone still impresses. Perfectly timed group choreography, a precursor to Queen Bee. It was that Janet Jackson fans' Twitter feed that pointed out what an important week this was for her in Tokyo. She broke a record in Japan that hasn't been broken since. Janet Jackson sold out 3 shows at the Tokyo Dome, capacity 55,000, in 4 minutes. 3 shows in 4 minutes. So with that as the gold standard at the Dome, we leave you today with a passport to Rhythm Nation. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. Our theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. We tweet at PRI The World. I'm at Marco Werman on Twitter and Instagram. We'll be back with you on Monday. See you then.
PRI, Public Radio International.